session number 24654, Reel 7.
Jack, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to give more time to contribute to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive, our second interview. If we may, we'll pick up just a little bit before, we'll start just a little bit before where we ended last time. And I'd like to take you back to the beginning of January 1945, and I think you're in the Ardennes. Obviously, difficult conditions, I would think. Perhaps you could just give a brief re-description of that period, and then you can tell me something about when you had to fly home on compassionate leave.
Right. We'll start in, let's say from New Year's Day. My battalion was just outside Liège, having gone down to the Ardennes with the 43rd Division as a part of the reinforcement to prevent the American breakthrough, and on New Year's, up to New Year's Day, just before that, there had been we weren't in direct contact with the Germans, but we'd had a lot of German air attack before that, and then our own air force was unable to operate because of the appalling weather conditions.
But the Germans could.
Well, they'd operated a bit before, so it was. I'm talking about a period about 4 or 5 days before Christmas, but the whole of the Christmas period, the Germans, our Air Force, at a crucial time, because of the German breakthrough, were not unable to operate because of the weather, and of course the Germans at that time weren't either. And then on New Year's Day, we're talking about weather conditions which. The coldest I've ever experienced in my life. It was really freezing in every respect. Although we were largely in billets, you know, living in houses, although we set up a defence position, we didn't have to occupy it because it was a part of the fallback position in case the Germans broke through at Liège. Meanwhile, what the Germans were doing were hammering us with V1s. V1s were falling on the Asian very considerable number and all in that area as well. But on New Year's Day, the weather broke. It was freezing cold and brilliant sunshine. And the Air Force came out in considerable numbers. And that really was, in a sense, the beginning of the end, as far as the Germans were concerned, because they were really pounded.
Can I just ask you, if I may, Jack, leaving aside the V1 aerial activity, how extensive was German air activity at that time? I didn't realise that they still had an air force that was...
Oh yes, they had an air force, but it wasn't that extensive. You get 3 or 4 aircraft, probably at the most. We certainly didn't have any bomber aircraft. There'd be fighter bombers. Maybe 110s and FW-190s, if I remember rightly. It wasn't a serious thing. The biggest one was the V1s, which were totally unexpected. Mind you, the V1s falling on the edge meant the V1s weren't falling quite so much on London, although they were in one sense. For reasons I'll explain in a moment. So we were there until, I can't remember when at the moment, I should have brought my notes from there again. For about 5 or 6 days until the back of the German attack, which of course was aimed at Antwerp, had failed completely, and they were beginning to withdraw pretty rapidly. We were then moved up to, we moved from there up to Nijmegen with the intention, the plan was to clear the line of the Rhine-Maas, but more particularly, as far as we were concerned, was to clear the Reichswald, which of course is that massive great wood on the Dutch-German frontier. We had a bit of territory into Germany at that moment. It was only a mile or two, as I remember, and my battalion was very close to that, so one was actually in Germany from time. That was our first foot of the British of getting into Germany itself. Whilst I was there, I received a message from that came down from the higher ups to say my parents' home had been bombed by a V2. They lived in Barking in Essex. They actually weren't, the house wasn't, but it was a building next door, which almost next door, which was a Methodist church hall, had been used by, was being occupied by an ACAT battery. And they got a direct hit from the V2 and just killed them all, really. And we were only about 75 yards from it. My parents' home and all the adjacent buildings were very seriously damaged. They themselves were knocked about and put into hospital, but they weren't in hospital long, so they weren't that bad, actually. And so I was given the opportunity to get in 7 days' leave to go back. That was fairly common because they realised that the troops had their families bombed back home. You know, it was bad on morale. Anyway, I was given 7 days' leave to go home, which was, in one sense, a bit awkward because I was the battalion I own. I was a part of the planning set up for the battalion attack that we were going to be involved in. And I managed to get hold of, I had a battalion truck to take me back to Brussels, and I called a Wellington back from there, back to Stansted Airport, and went home for 5 days. Kathleen came and joined me down from the north of England. I must say, we had quite a lot of V1s and B2s from flying on that part of London where we were. I'm in one sense glad to get back to the safety of the trenches, because I knew where I was there. I understood that situation. I didn't like the London bit, I must admit.
From your memory, attacks did you have in Barking in the 5 days that you were there?
I think that was the only B2 on where we were. But they were always overhead, you see, so you didn't know where they were going to land. The V2 that landed on us was one of the worst casualties in London. It was one of the biggest. There was a bigger one at Ilford, and there was one down in South London.
It was
really big, but there was a lot of. There was two or three a day were landing somewhere in London. One of the problems was that. Certainly as far as V1s were concerned, because they would be met by RAF aircraft, fighter aircraft, and they would shoot them down or tip them over. That way they used to fly under the wing and just tip the thing and tip them off the course. Well, of course, if they got too close to London and shot them down, they weren't helping anybody, but they just still came down. So the object of the exercise was to try and shoot them down somewhere over Kent or Sussex, wherever. By that time, the V2s, V1s were not so, were not the threat on London that the V2s became. The V1s, because the sites in northern France, which they, or sorry, in northern Europe, were, of course, had been overrun. So they were having to fly these things quite long distance from Germany, really, mostly from Germany. And Holland, of course, northern Holland. But they lost a lot of sales, so they were dependent on the V2s, which was a more effective weapon from their point of view. But they were pretty horrific. Anyway, so I then rejoined the battalion.
Before you rejoined the battalion, what was the condition of London in January 1945 like?
I think people were very edgy. I mean, they didn't like these. I mean, I think they understood the bomber situation because you've got proper air raid warnings and you've got the shelters. But so you could be walking, you know, shopping area or somewhere, and you suddenly hear a noise, and then you were waiting for the cut out, and the engine cut out, and that's when it coming down. So you, as soon as you heard a cut out, ducked into a doorway quick. I think people were very edgy indeed. If we were not having the success we were having in Northwest Europe, you know, if it had been sort of 42 and that was happening, I think morale would have been very low, a very tricky situation. Because we were having successes elsewhere, I suppose they put up with it to some extent, but it was. Yes, I don't think morale was very high among population generally, particularly in, you know, where they were in the target areas, which was mostly London and the south coast generally, who were getting these bombs.
From what you can recall, were rations and supplies generally better in the army in Northern Europe or better in at home? In other words,
I don't know if it's better. I mean, we were quite well fed in the army, partly because the ration system that we had and the ration pack systems, which had very considerable variety in them. I think the range of meals worked over a 14-day period, so therefore. Your ration pack, you might be unfortunate and have the same one for 4 days running, but by and large, there was variety, which was the envy of the Americans. They would give anything to get out of our rations because they had the same ration, K ration, all the time, and they would exchange anything for. I mean, they would exchange a jeep for a load of ration packs, and they did. I mean, we acquired a lot of jeeps, a lot of.
This has gone on ever since because I heard that in the Gulf recently that the price of when the British arrived they didn't have the right tents or something, and the price of a decent tent for 8 men was two bottles of Johnny Walker Black Label.
Oh yeah, well, and we would have had the same with the Americans because they were not allowed alcohol.
Were they not?
No. And we had rum, of course, and we had alcohol, we had whiskey and things like that. And they would give their right arm for that. And in fact, I'm going back along a bit, you know, back to the Arnhem thing. When we were being, just after the withdrawal of the airborne, and we were being relieved by American Airborne Battalion, and came in late at night, and we just had a rum ration come up. And we offered this American colonel a glass of it. He never met rum in his life, so he... And he said, what do you call this? We said, well, Nelson's blood, you see. Gee, that guy had some blood. But a bottle of whiskey was something we would often give to Americans and in exchange for something. And in fact, towards the end of the war, I think throughout, I mean, it was quite a common thing, too common, I suppose. We could write off a carrier, which they had, you know, the half-track carrier vehicle, which the Americans liked. And so we'd write one off, give it to them for 2 or 3 jeeps, and then order another carrier, so to replace it.
A half-track carrier being a Bren gun carrier?
Bren carrier, yeah. They loved them.
Did they?
Oh, yeah. So we'd exchange one of our carriers for a couple of their jeeps. I can always remember, I think the battalion establishment of jeeps was 18. And when I handed over the battalion at the end of the war, because I was the last officer of the battalion, I finally handed all the stuff back. And I think we handed back about 40 jeeps. Most of the officers had their own personal jeep, which we'd all would have acquired from the Americans and that. The other thing one wanted from them, you liked their jeeps. You occasionally had their rations, because that was a change for us. We were quite well off with cigarettes, although some people like me, it was a bit of just a swap. But they had cigars. So if you were a cigar smoker, they'd like to have cigars. You get cigars from them in exchange for rations or a bottle of whiskey or something. A lot of our troops liked their boots than we did. A lot of our soldiers would wear German boots or American boots. Well, mainly the two options you had. And of course, you wanted automatic pistols.
Jack, you've just mentioned automatic pistols there. You were obviously keen on acquiring them.
Yeah, I think most officers like to use the Remington 9mm or German Mauser and that, rather than the 3.8 that we had, which was not quite such an effective weapon, mainly because it was a slower weapon. It took time to each round to reload itself into the next chamber.
If you were using German equipment, where did you get the ammunition from?
Well, there was no problem about that. There was plenty of ammunition around.
Was
that? Oh, yes, yeah. So, you got the gun, you're likely to get it quite a lot. You capture anywhere. There was always ammunition around.
Right.
Yeah, so that was not a problem. Mind you, you use it very often. It was a pretty rare, dangerous situation for us to have to use a pistol. I think I used a pistol about two or three times. That was about all. And when I did that was a 3.8 and not a mouse.
And would those three occasions that you used your pistol, would they be the only occasions that you fired? Fired small arms?
No, we fired a rifle.
You did?
Yes. We all, I was able to submachine gun. And that was another weapon, you see, that was popular to get Thompson submachine gun rather than the Sten gun. And the Americans would use Thompson submachine guns. Because we thought the Sten gun was a very dangerous weapon for inflicting wounds on yourself.
Was it?
Yes. If you dropped it, for example, there was no way it would... the bolt itself was not locked. So if you dropped it, particularly on its butt, it's just likely to go off. And it did, on several occasions for people. Most people used them. So Thompson's was a popular weapon. The popular weapon, no doubt about it, was the Schmeisser. The German submachine gun. A lot of troops had German submachine guns. They just captured them and they all had them. The German submachine gun was a very popular weapon. And even in one sense, a bit like, I suppose, what Wellington's army in Spain must have looked like. We had everything but what we were issued with. We all acquired things. We dressed differently, and that. But that was part of the morale, confidence building, whatever, allow people to do what they thought was appropriate for themselves, for battle anyway. So going back to where I was at the time, as I said, I rejoined the battalion in mid-January.
You flew from Stansted into Wellington, I think, or flew into Stansted.
I flew into Stansted to Wellington. I can't remember what sort of aircraft I went back in, but something similar. And that, incidentally, when I flew into Sandton and Wellington, was the first time I'd ever flown. So that was an experience in itself. You know, I'd never been in an aircraft before.
Did you have to sit in the bomb bay, or did you sit?
No, they had buckets. They'd made for about four or five passengers, four or five bucket seat type things, and that. And anyway, I rejoined the battalion in January, and where we were still in the middle of, meanwhile the Reichswald battle was over, so I rejoined the battalion actually in the Reichswald, where we were then planning the battle of to clear, as I said, the Rhine-Mars battle, where we were to go through Cleve down to Gok, but eventually, of course, reached the bank of the Rhine, which we did all the way along. So yes, that brought me back to the battalion. And where
did the battalion participate in the Reichswald battle?
Oh yes, yeah. Yes, that was the whole division. And well, there were two divisions, if I remember rightly. I may be wrong there, so I wasn't actually there. And we'd be ourselves and the 53rd Welsh Division. I don't know whether there was an armour division. I doubt whether there were, because, I mean, it's not suitable tank country. Although, of course, we would have had tanks supporting us anyway, from one of the tank regiments supporting us. That was a key battle across the road, as far as the Germans were concerned. I mean, that was their...
Why was that?
Well, it's the edge of the... It's the first time it brings us into the Siegfried Line. And brought us to the edge of the sort of northern part of the Siegfried Line. And once that fell, it really unlocked everything as far as the Germans were concerned. It turned the Siegfried Line. And that's what the Rhine-Mars attack was, because that was rolling up the Siegfried Line, which meant you were in pretty tough defences the whole time. And probably the most difficult part of the whole war. I mean, it was more difficult than Normandy. Casualties were higher. It really was pretty horrific. I mean, it was as near to World War I as you'll ever get, that we ever got. A bit like, you know, a series of Monte Cassinos.
So you lived in trenches?
Oh yes, there were two major problems. One was the trenches, and the other thing was the Germans flooded the area. They released all the dikes and dams, and there was considerable flooding in the whole area. And eventually, after the battle was over, whilst we were still clearing it up to some extent and preparing ourselves for the Rhine crossing. I mean, we were using ducks all the time to move from one company base to another. You just had a duck. and
that would take vehicles, of course, I assume, as well, or just men?
No, just take men. Don't take men. No, we must have had... we also had some amphibious vehicles as well. Yes, we did have amphibious vehicles, but APCs that were amphibious. Not APCs, they were not that. They were some form of troop carriers, very lightly armoured, if armoured at all, really. Yes. But they were amphibious, so we had the ducks as well. I don't remember it being flooded to the point that you couldn't have used, you know, big vehicles. In fact, we probably did. I can't remember, frankly.
Can I ask you on the casualties question? The war is drawing to an end. That is quite obvious, and probably no one thought, not even the most optimistic German thought, that it would last longer than 1945. Yet the Germans were fighting ferociously still, defending their own country now. And casualties were high on the British side. Was there a recognition, did you get a recognition at your level in the battalion that you had to be extremely careful? Because I just wonder, when you suffered casualties, was it possible to replace them, or was, if you like, the operational effectiveness of the frontline forces very slowly constricting because you couldn't replace people?
Well, no, I don't think there was anything like that. What was the case, almost from Normandy onwards, we were going to be short of infantry. We were running out of reserves. And that was overcome initially by converting light ACAT regiments to infantry. And a lot of those came from Italy, because the Italian war was winding up. So they brought troops from Italy. I don't think there was any normal infantry brought from Italy. There were conversions. Our gunner regiments, mainly ACAT regiments, because the air threat had disappeared. So, I mean, my own battalion, I can remember we had a equivalent of one company load of them. And in fact, I can remember saying on more than one occasion after the war that these people had all had a 6 weeks conversion course, if I remember rightly, something like that, 6 week conversion course, to infantry. And they was as good as we were.
Right.
Yeah, I thought so. We all thought so. And they were first class, and it worked. I thought you might have been leading up to say about one's attitude towards casualties, but I think it's probably true that up to the Rhine, although, well, when we were dashing across France, we thought the war was over. You know, Germans were really on the run. We thought, in a sense, the main part of the war was over, and it was going to be quick. And of course, then the effect of Arnhem, the Battle of the Reichswalds and the Ardennes and that, made people realise, well, it wasn't over. We had a lot more to do. Although people were always trying to avoid casualties, there wasn't a sort of conscious thing to say, well, then let's do it. I think there were among some of the American forces that it was over. And I mean, that was one of the reasons why the Ardennes actually happened, because they hit a weak part of the Americans, broke through their 7th Division, who had already made up their mind the war was over and they were not really looking out properly. But we didn't. Once we crossed the Rhine, I think people were avoiding casualties like mad, because then we knew the war would put it over. And in fact, and I may have mentioned this before, well, one of the saddest things was one of the, we had a very first class, one of our first class officers who was a chap who'd got the MC, young man, I don't think he was a Canadian, no, he was British, Peter Thorpe by name, and he was killed on the last day of the war by a sniper. And I think people were more upset about that than almost anything.
And in your battalion?
In my battalion, yeah. Peter Thorpe. And very popular young officer. But I think people were trying to avoid casualties as much as possible. By that, but certainly by the time we crossed the Rhine.